Hello. It's good to talk to you. Now that we're in week two, we're a sensible size. You can't tell how many people are in the room when there isn't any room, but when we begin writing and editing, it will be helpful that I have enough time to work hard on everybody's writing. We have, reached the stage where we can also begin to work on the in-person or small group close contact forms of being separated. So let me just spend a moment on mechanics about that. Beginning 2 weeks from now, or maybe a little sooner, depending upon how the schedule works, for those people who are local, there will be outdoor face-to-face small group meetings. We should be able to stick to six or seven people and me at a time. And the sign-up sheet for outdoor in-person instruction will be published on Thursday of this week, that is the 24th, so that we can begin to find a way to rotate times so that everybody gets a chance to meet me more or less every week face-to-face outside. Now, to make the principle of equality in instruction work, which ought to be in place in every course, what that means for students who are not local is that we will find times for small group conference telephone calls so that we should be able to have a chance to talk directly to one another once again, more or less every week. Here, time zones become much more of an issue. And what we'll try and do is sort by time zones so that people can have reasonable hours in which to talk to me without my having to keep unreasonable hours around the clock all the time, too. But that should be feasible. It's not a big deal. When I get the outdoor instruction timing set through sign-up over the next few days, then it should be possible for us also to put up a conference call schedule that would make some sense and get signups for that. So we'll start pushing the pieces of the in-person instruction system together now and equalize it with the conference call system now that we have stable enrollment and I know how many and I can begin to figure out how many slots. The other part of mechanics is your writing. From my point of view, the way that schedule will function is that there will be a first draft of your first essay, which I will want to have in the wiki in the first week in October for the first draft of the first paper, and of the first week in November for the first draft of the second essay. So at the beginning of each month, you will have some first draft to write, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in due course. But remember that the way essays work is they are less than 1,000 words. They are never more than 1,000 words. You can't pass with an essay that's over 1,000 words. A draft that is over 1,000 words will get rejected for pruning before editing can even begin. So a first draft means, as a second draft means, 1,000 words or less on an idea of yours, not of mine or of other people's, but yours. That is to say, you are trying to communicate to your readership, including me as your editor, an idea that you have and that you think it is worth their time to read. That's the principle on which the essay works. It doesn't work on the principle of I tell you what to write. It works on the principle of you tell me and everybody else that you want to have read this thing what's important, what you're thinking about, what you've decided, what you've come up with, what you're concerned about, what you're deeply questioning, right? It isn't necessarily a case in which what you're doing is arguing a conclusion. The point of communicating with other people is not always to force them to have your idea, though apparently that's the mode in which everybody is most comfortable these days. So, the first draft of essays will be needed at the beginning of October and at the beginning of November. I say needed rather than due, because the point is that the schedule of editing has to fit the schedule of writing. It's due is the function of the need. So, I need the first draft of the first essay in the beginning of October so that I can edit it in the first half of October, so that I can be sure that by the middle of October you have an edit on your draft and you're ready to think about how to improve it, given what I have said about how I think it could be improved. And it would be terrific if in the second half of October you completed the second draft of the first essay so that I could then maybe even figure out how we could make it still better, and a third essay draft could occur of that first topic. But that's not necessarily the way your schedule is going to work. So all I need is for the first essay to have been rewritten by the time I have to submit grades. And the same is true with the second essay. If you have been able to produce the first draft in the first week of November, which you should, then I can be sure that by the time we cease the fiction of in-person instruction at Columbia Law School around Thanksgiving, that you have the edit of the second essay, first draft also. And therefore, you could conceivably be rewriting at the end of November and be done with the course about the time that everybody else's tension begins. Or you could take longer to rewrite the second essay. And at any rate, I'm going to do whatever I can to keep learning going. If you are coming with me into the second part of the year in computers, privacy, and the Constitution, then we will try to make all the writing part of the same overall experience, even though it may be in two different webs in the wiki and about four different kinds of subjects. And if this is the last time we're going to work together this year, then I'm at least going to say that in a world in which we all have formally agreed that semesters don't exist, there's no reason from my point of view why we can't keep working on your writing for as long as you feel like doing it, the only thing being that the forces will require grades at a certain point, and we have to obey what the forces need. That's mechanics as I know it now, and so you'll have questions, and we'll talk about them in whichever context. You put them in your journal, you bring them up on the pad, we talk about them in the park, we talk about them over the phone. The point is to use as many different modes of communication as possible, of different kinds, so as to allow people to learn in whatever way it is that they find most convenient given the constraints under which we are working, and so that I can support that learning in whatever way is most productive for each student and me. The goal of the technology is not to extract information resources. In fact, we are careful to use all forms of technology in forms of those technologies that don't cause data mining to occur. Nobody is leaking anything here from the wiki to anywhere else. That is to say, I mean, it may be that Google indexes things that are publicly available to the web. I don't stop Google from indexing, or any other search engine for that matter, from indexing things which we have published that anyone on the web is supposed to be able to read. My principle is that if people on the web are supposed to be able to read it, then it would be good if they could search for it. On the other hand, those things which nobody is supposed to see except us, like student journals, for example, there's no indexing available because Google cannot see that they are there, and that's the way it's supposed to be. with respect to any particular thing you write, you control the privacy of it using those little incantations that you see down at the bottom of the page. And things default in some way that makes sense. Journals are obviously by default private, and essays are by default public. If you can write an op-ed, then you want people to be able to read it, and you want them to be able to find it, but that doesn't mean that you can't, by removing two characters from that little test incantation at the bottom of the page, you can do whatever it is that you want to do about that. You can make things visible only to the other members of the course, you can make things visible only to me, you can make things invisible to everybody in the world except you and me. Whatever it is that you want to do, you can do very flexibly. The goal, however, at the end of the day, whether it's the stuff on the pad, or it's the stuff in the wiki, or it's what you write in a journal, or it's what we talk about on the phone, is that we are in control of how that information is used. There isn't any reason why any particular technology can't be built that way. One of the fundamental lessons that we're going to depend upon in order to analyze the law and the politics of the situation in which humanity now finds itself, one of the cardinal principles that we will be developing is that there isn't any form of technology we need that we have to tolerate data mining in order to have. We're allowing data mining, and we're benefiting from services that are subsidized for us at price zero by the data miners just so they can watch us use them and so they can have access to the spy satellite that we have agreed to carry around for them, or at least that you have agreed to carry around for them. But we're going to be insistent upon the proposition that there is always another way to do it. There is no technology that requires the surrender of all this power to the people who collect the behavior. And I will, of course, try at each stage in this process to point out that the technology we use, whatever it is that we want, used whatever it is the way we want to use it, the business of learning can continue to go on without having to surrender to the business of data mining. I'm going to produce the technology we use to make that point evident, as I'm going to try and make evident the intellectual counterpart, which is that learning which occurs under a system of surveillance and data mining is not free learning, doesn't produce the freedom of the mind, and therefore isn't healthy from the point of view of the system we have tried to build up over the last 1,000 years in the well taken care of corners of humanity. The system we call freedom of thought. So I'm going to make clear at each stage in which we learn together using the technology that the epidemic makes ever more important to us, that all of the services we receive that we think we are now completely dependent upon in the form in which we receive them, services that we think are really important to the way we live our lives and for which we think we have to tolerate the large-scale destruction of privacy and the elimination of freedom of thought and with it political self-governance and what we are pleased to call free will. Once we have accepted that this is somehow necessary in order to get things upon which we are dependent, we will tolerate. But if we are at all times conscious that this architecture of services how we get the digital services we now think of as crucial to running our lives for, quote, free, close quote, in return to for access to all the behavior, once we have understood that that's just a choice and that another future is possible, and that the way we learn about that other future that is possible is by observing that people out there in the world have proved the concept of doing it a different way and have a running code that you can actually do it. Then it becomes evident that we can have as much freedom as we want, provided that we're willing to choose it. This is an idea which came into the world of the so-called West, actually kind of the North Middle, at the end of the 18th century, as a result of events in North America that fractured the first British Empire, and as a result of an immensity of change in human weather that we call the French Revolution. But this idea that another world is possible and that people can build it as citizens with their collective hands, and that they can make us something that will be better than the thing they have because it will be more in accord with human need, this idea, which actually goes back in that north middle well-off part of the world to at least the utopia of Thomas More, That idea, well, as we'll see next time, it is utterly valuable and always, at best, in danger, even where it has been allowed to exist and we have sort of triumphed for a time. But when the human community made the net and began altering on a scale even larger than the scale of alteration that brought the idea of civic freedom and freedom of thought and freedom of inquiry and democratic self-government into the world, way bigger even than that, bigger than anything which has happened for many thousand years. When the human race began to build the network, a new nervous system for itself, not within a human being but across a species, the challenges faced by that small party in the human race that has been agitating for the last 1,000 years or so for freedom, the problems of those people fundamentally changed. When Dangier said, this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice, part of what he meant is that the idea of freedom and all these different ways tied up together as a political idea was dependent upon a certain set of technological conditions in the human race. It is hard to imagine the rise of these ideas for just to take the most obvious example, without the development of movable type printing and the onset of the first mass-produced article in human culture, the book. But in any event, what Dan means when he says that this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice is that new infrastructure of human existence is being laid down. Anatomy of a nervous system which embraces not the human being within the body but all human beings across the world. A nervous system, the current anatomy of which we call the internet. And the current physiology of which is the process of services provision to humanity in return for all the behavior of humanity. A form of anatomy which is coherent and which is capable under the right hands, and those hands already exist and are applying themselves deliberately and carefully and thoughtfully to the work, which is capable in the right hands of eliminating the very idea of freedom from the human race. So, the purpose of the work we are doing together is to enable you to ask questions about whether that is so, and whether it is happening, and what to do about it if it is. Because my submission underlying all of this to you is that this is among the most important subjects, along with the change in the Earth's climate for which lawyers might want to be trained to work in the 21st century. There are no larger or more important questions in the social life of the 21st century than those two questions. And it seems to me that lawyers should be trained to work, however else they may also work in their practices, on those two things, one or the other of them at least. And so my intention here, in this course that doesn't meet except when it sort of does, sort of this way, sort of that way, in which meeting, after all, is really not very important because we are held together by that nervous system of the human race, which allows teaching to occur in the nervous system. And the fundamental question is, who does the teaching, the humans or the machines? Is it about the switches, or is it about the people? That fundamental question. Is the one that we are exploring and living through and resisting against and most importantly asking questions about, so that we can, enjoying the fruit of the tree before it has been cut down completely, freely determine for ourselves what questions are important, how to think about them, how to learn about them, how to write about them, and therefore how to teach others about them, which is what it is that actually makes us human among the hominoid primates, our mode of teaching one another, and thus allows us to understand what it is that we have to lose in this development going on. So in the beginning, because everybody comes to Columbia Law School to study capitalism, that is the domain of most important study, or because Marxists would want to know how does everything come out of the political economy structure of social life, or because I actually think whether you're a capitalist or a Marxist, you want to understand the social history of anything, you do need to ask about the material matters first. I've tried to lay the groundwork before we come to the anatomy of the new extraskeletal species-wide nervous system. I want to lay the groundwork before the anatomy, before the physiology, and before, well, everything that the Marxist thinker would call superstructure. I want to explain the political economy of how we built this nervous system. We have another one we are building, but we built the first one, and the first one is the one which took on this life of its own. To begin with, then, there was a problem with nuclear war. It isn't just that the science fiction spawned by the prospect of nuclear war, motivated those of us who were in my generation of the struggle for this kind of freedom of the mind. It's that nuclear weapons in and of themselves brought this nervous system into being as though it were like a Godzilla in the Japanese imagination, the outcome of irradiation. It's not surprising that that idea, that the mutation of the environment comes from the nuclear weapons themselves, began in Japanese culture after the Second World War. But it isn't just that that idea ricocheted around through all the imaginative writers who imagined the world in which, as a child and a tween, I grew up. It's that, as Einstein said after the test at Trinity, we've changed everything except the way man thinks. Nuclear weapons put the problem of the technology of common thinking on the table of the narrow specialists whose job it is to wage and win war. In the process of developing their way of managing the bilateral nuclear standoff for the life in the Northern Hemisphere between the Soviet Union and the United States, the American military found itself trying to understand how to respond to a first strike by the other side that would decapitate command and control capacity and make it difficult to organize the retaliatory response through the destruction of the ability to communicate command and control to weapon silos. This fundamental problem, how to deal with the possible decapitation of political and military command and control, led the United States military to want to research the ideas of non-hierarchical networks of computing hardware that could therefore withstand the problem of intended nuclear decapitation by operating in the absence of the superior nodes. This idea, the idea of creating what we could think of in the purely narrow sense as a democratic network, not one run with a couple of central places that you could hit with a nuclear bomb and that would be it, that idea motivated in the late 1960s the onset of research, which in the mid-1970s, about the time that I was becoming a teen professional too, motivated the creation of the Defense Advanced Research Products Agency, the ARPANET, which developed directly into the set of principles for construction that we called the Internet. The first neurons in this nervous system were laid down there at the intersection of geopolitics and the military problem of mutual assured destruction as a system of peacekeeping. Of course, in addition to those military emphases, there were academic research emphases for the creation of similar activities, equally not hierarchically intended, but rather part of the system of freedom of thought, the free exchange of ideas and scientific knowledge and technical understanding and cultural, you know, detritus, which also was part of the original building of the net. And its academic portions, with their fundamental commitment to non-hierarchicalism and freedom of thought, were oddly conjoined to a military system which believed not in a non-hierarchical freedom of thought, but in hierarchy and discipline, but which also needed to deal with a technical problem of potential decapitation. And out of those two quite different motivations leading in the same direction, the initial plan of this nervous system was completely decentralized. The goal was to make it possible for all computers to communicate without having to know anything about one another's operating systems or data representations or ways of doing anything, so that a thousand flowers could bloom at the level of technical architecture and the network would embrace them all, and that nobody was in total charge of anything, and that everything was done by making rules which anybody could follow and be part of the community of online computers. That process of defining rules which could be in operation by agreement of all parties is actually the way that the thing we call the internet runs. Services in the net are based on what we call protocols, that is, rules of signaling with one another. We'll see this in a moment further when we consider the fundamental anatomy of the net. Computers do things at other computers' requests, and we call those services. And services, therefore, are embedded in protocols, which are just rule sets for getting things done. Machine A says hi to a particular address at machine B, and machine B says, hi, what can I do for you? And machine A says, here's what I would like you to do for me, and machine B says, okay, I have done it, here it is, and hands the machine A something, and they say, okay, thank you very much, goodbye, goodbye, and lovely to talk to you, etc., except they don't use that particular language because they have a different, quote, protocol. And how do we establish protocols in the net which say things like, hi, I would like to give you an email message. Okay, I will take an email message from you. Who are you? I am this. Okay, give me this message. Where do you want it to go? Yes, I know such a person. No, I don't know such a person. Here, I will do it for you. Maybe I could send it on. Whatever it is, give it to me. Okay, thank you very much. Bye, etc. How do we establish how that email thing works, what the headers have to be in? Those kinds of rules about services are produced in the world of the internet in documents which are known as RFCs. Every protocol of importance in the net has an RFC and a number attached to it, from starting from one. An RFC means request for consensus. The fundamental process by which network physiology is ultimately determined is consensus among equal parties. Everybody entirely engaged in what, at least fictively, is described as merely a technical exercise. The IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, which organizes the development of and progress of RFCs through their various stages, the Internet Engineering Task Force takes the position that every human being associated with its process is there on the making of technical decisions only. This is fictive, of course. But the fiction of equally uninvolved, non-self-interested technical decision makers, like a number of other of the fictions of the internet, is a democratic fiction based upon the principle of equality and non-hierarchy. Which means that that is embedded at some level in the very nature of the cellular processes that make up this nervous system, though that's not the way it's turning out at the moment. It is the root reason why another future is always possible. So the initial political economy of the net, of the nervous system itself, is the Cold War on the American side. But the political economy beyond that is the political economy of the value to capitalism, of the forms of communication that are made possible. By the time I was, as a teenager, beginning to work as a professional computer programmer, the political economy of the net was the building of the ability of businesses to communicate first internally and then with one another in order to produce in the economy. The management theorists in the United States and elsewhere in the so-called free world after the Second World War, the management theorists believed that the fundamental bottleneck in the performance of organized firms in the economy was their ability to know. That their information gap was the source of their primary inefficiencies in production. And so the world of developing digital computation and signaling and communication offered businesses the opportunity to collect more information about production and to organize it better. And for that reason, they dealt with the IBM Corporation for mainframes, and they dealt with the telecommunications monopolists in their societies of origin, and they attempted to create ways of knowing their own business better. And I have described that as a process of the producers in society trying to study their own and their competitors' production, and that's crucially important. It was the driving political economy of the growth of the net from the first neurons in the military and the research universities to the broad spread of the network of data processing throughout the economy. Not yet about consumption, not yet about consumers, not yet about tracking behavior, none of that, of course not. But that's because the majority of the economy in the post-war advanced world was about production. In the last quarter of the 20th century, as post-war prosperity and the development of national and regionally integrated markets and all the other panoply of success overcame the wealthy world, the balance of the value of production and consumption in the economy decisively shifted. In the late 1970s in the United States and elsewhere in the world, on various clocks, consumption became the majority of the gross domestic product of the big economies. Consumption became the majority of economic activity. In the early 21st century, the coupling of the two most importantly growing economies in the world, that of the United States and that of China, created a fusion which came to be known as Chimerica, based upon the fact that the productive power, the manufacturing power of a Chinese economy, now using capitalist technologies of production and finance and drawing upon an enormous proletariat in creation, allowed the United States economy to base itself ever more upon the real engines of its 21st century growth, consumption, and debt. But when your economy is primarily about consumers, is primarily about consumption, the GDP of the United States is over 70% consumption throughout the decade preceding the epidemic. When your economy is overwhelmingly about consumption, you don't use the net to study production anymore. You use the net to study consumers. Because after all, from the political economy point of view within capitalism, it's the consumers who produce the consumption which is the economy's most important activity. So you study consumers. If the political economy of your collection of people, let us call them Lakota, after the arrival of horses in North America, is the hunting of buffalo on the high plains, then what you study is the buffalo. That's to say that in the course of the 21st century, business adapted the building out of the network, its constant proliferation, and the most important thing, the reach of digital services into the lives of ordinary consumers. Business in the capitalist world treated this as the place towards which to pivot in order to study consumers, and it began to use the network to collect not the behavior of its factories, not the behavior of its machines, not the flow of its energy supplies, not indeed the whole of its supply chain, but rather its consumers. And the political economy that is finishing the task of bringing the net into proximity with the entirety of all human minds from birth onward in the course of the next 20 years, the political economy of that process is driven primarily by the capitalist desire to study, understand, predict, and influence the consumer. The process of understanding how the state responds to all of this will largely be, as it always is, in my spring of every year in the other offering, Computers, Privacy, and the Constitution, which is essentially about what happens when the state comes in. But for the moment, we are indeed thinking primarily about the political economy of the private society, of civil society in all of its reaches, and the commercial activities of businesses. They are indeed why the nervous system has been so much better developed in the wealthy capitalist parts of the world, because that's where the consumers first matter and the network drives at them. It's also why in the least developed parts of the world, the smartphone nonetheless is proliferating and the network is getting there, because the world's poor too have behavior and capturing it is highly valuable. If the behavior of the poor is highly valuable, why aren't the poor getting rich? Well, of course, there are good answers to that question. We shall have to spend some time asking, is it because the poor don't own their behavior? Or is it because the poor require services at price zero and we would have to compete at price zero against capitalism? And, well, what would prevent us from doing that? Capitalism competes poorly at price zero. But we have to build an alternative political economy first, which we will do three or 4 weeks from now. But in the beginning, we are trying to understand the process of nourishment, the basic metabolism that built the net. And so, as you see, it grows outward from the peculiar combination of anti-hierarchical concerns of the highly hierarchical military and the anti-hierarchical concerns of the highly anti-hierarchical academic world, and is transmuted through a series of structures of business enterprise after the Second World War, the first being American industrial power and productive might, and the second being the great turn towards a consumer-focused economy in which Chimerica did its manufacturing in China and its consuming in the United States, and its indebting on both sides. What happens in the process is also a change in the political economy of culture in a way that we need also to set out at the beginning. 20th century mass media and all the role of the structure of one-to-many broadcasting, the hierarchical structure of a few have big, tall towers and they send out their signals and everybody set receives. That structure of information flow in society also was structured around the relationship between, quote, free, close quote, and the influencing of consumers, because broadcasting by its nature, mass media by its nature, is directed at the mass. It isn't important whether consumption is the bigger or the smaller part of the economy. It is there to influence consuming. And so broadcasting, 20th century structures of information flow also provided, quote, for free, close quote, in return for advertising, for the opportunity to push. Precisely because it was a form of one-to-many communication, it didn't receive back. And the powerful didn't get the information about the behavior, but they got the chance to push on it. And they tried to find buttons that were pushable. And beer commercials worked like this, and soap commercials worked like that. And beer and soap was pretty much the two pieces of the human psyche and the way that the system worked them. In that world, the world of the broadcast information production and the advertisement which was trying to push a consumer button but which didn't have any really specific information about behavior or consumers themselves internally from moment to moment, in that world, the entertainment or the news or the sunrise semester or whatever it was the thing of value that had to be paid for through the commercial. It was the actual value received and the thing for which people paid. After the fundamental turn in the construction of the net, after the character of the net became the one in which we now exist, the real value was the information about behavior coming back. And the information, entertainment, pornography, whatever it was, as I said in Berlin, just the cheese on the stage of the mousetrap. It was the thing given away in order to get the thing of value. The reality of that in economic terms conceals the political reality. It conceals the geometry of actual power. The product of Facebook is information about people using it. The low-quality sharing services given by Facebook and Instagram to the world, those are not the thing of value. That's the thing you chum in order to get the big fish, which is the stuff coming back the other way. In other words, the product of Facebook is the people. Soylent Green is people, right? This was why in 2010 I said Mr. Zuckerberg had done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age, which didn't sound right in 2010 to most people, but now in 2020, merely a decade later, has a whole lot more traction. General Bowie was on the front page of the New York Times last week saying just that very thing. And the result, this happened because people figured out in some unspoken pre-analytic sense that they were the product now. And that this other stuff was wrapping paper thrown at them to become the product and to dress themselves in. That's what happened in the political economy of the net. and I've tried to show you how it occurred and what the steps were and how the liberalization of telecommunications in the mid-1990s in the United States, followed by boomlets of the same structure around the world, produced, well, not what they thought they were producing, but produced the political economy of the system. The Telecoms Act of 96 is uniquely instructive in this sense. It's an enormously complicated set of trade-offs within and among industries based around the idea that nobody gets a monopoly, but little duopolies are allowed to exist in each of the things, radio and satellite radio and TV, and that they will then converge and compete with one another, and the duopolies will produce a supposedly competitive economy through a geometry which was also based, of course, around the measurement of the relative political power of the various oligopolies in the various verticals, all of which turned out to be irrelevant because the network was the terrain, not the electromagnetic spectrum. And these industries all collapsed and altered and reformed, and new ones came, and the platforms knocked everybody else into different corners of the board than they had been in before. But none of it could have been achieved without the underlying idea that government was going to get out of trying to architect information flow systems in society for social benefit. There are many things that can be said about how Facebook was allowed to ruin the world, but the most important was that no government agency believed it was their job to keep Facebook from doing so. One of the reasons you have a cleaner environment if you have an environment protection agency is that the people who have to work there are the people who will keep track of what is going on. Without a systematic way to understand social good from the point of view of anybody except the people making money out of it, Mr. Zuckerberg may look like a guy who's doing good. And to the extent that his services have integrated themselves into your life, you may feel he's doing good because you have services. Yeah, the services are poisonous. It's like, yeah, I have drinking water. It's not good for my baby. But on the other hand, at least I have drinking water, so I should be grateful to the guy who gives it to me. That's not the way people felt in Flint. And it's not the way they're going to feel in Flint for two generations at least to come. Because people remember what happens when the kind folks whose job it is to give them drinking water give them poison. If we understand the political economy of the net in this sense, then we can begin now to understand the anatomy of the nervous system that political economy enabled. In order to understand the net at the level of anatomy, you have to know that it is basically made of two things. Let us call them pipes and switches. A pipe is some structure, technical and social, which moves messages from point A to point B without altering the messages or controlling their flow. The pipe is the carrier, the way it gets there, from every A to every B and from every B back to every A. The purpose of the understanding of the net that is embodied in the design we call the internet, all those protocols written up in all those RFCs, the fundamental assumption about the piping of the net is it doesn't matter how things go from A to B. The rules of the internet could be made to work whether the thing that makes the pipe is a string between two tin cans, or a light wave in a optical fiber a thousandth the width of a human hair transmitted by a particular wavelength of laser light going down that optical fiber at the same moment that 100,000 other frequencies slightly different are also going down the pipe and producing simultaneous transmission of many messages between A and B all at once, millions in an hour, millions in a millisecond for that matter. Whether it's a copper wire or a coaxial cable entering a building where you live or work, it doesn't matter from the point of view of everything above it. The architecture thinks of the layer of carriage as a different layer from everything above it. No matter how the message goes, no matter whether the pipe is fast or slow, the rules will work as long as the pipe moves everything from A to B and B to A without changing it or trying to make any decision about it. So that's a pipe. The only other thing that exists in the net at this level of anatomical generality is the other kind of cell, the switch. A switch interconnects two or more pipes, and the switch's job is to determine which flows go where, when, to whom, under what circumstances, on what terms, and at what price. That's a switch. Naturally, in the networks we are talking about, a switch is a digital computer, but it needn't be. Again, the rules of the net would work just fine if every switch, except the ones closest to the A, original A, and the one closest to the original B, did nothing more than click and pass it on. But the net made of pipes and switches and operating according to the rules of the net has some important and interesting properties. The first thing to understand about its anatomy is that all of this net moves things called packets. Every message in moving in this nervous system, no matter how large and no matter what it consists of and no matter how we should interpret the data involved, every object of information or entertainment or useless gossip and humiliation moving through this net is broken into packets. A packet is pretty small, and on the order of 64 characters. Not even a tweet is one packet. In the world, you can be sure. So everything there is broken into tiny digital fragments, atomic in their nature to the network. Packets are what it moves. That means that the switches are deciding what to do with packets. They are packet switches. Once upon a time, before the Second World War or till shortly after, we had a telephone system that already spanned the continent and allowed us, using the miracle of long distance, to connect a telephone in New York City to a telephone in Los Angeles so people could shout at one another over it. The telephone system was operated on a network principle directly counter to the principle that we are just discussing. The original telephone system from Alexander Graham Bell to the beginning of the digital age, into the digital age, the reality of the telephone network was the opposite design. It was a circuit switched network. That means that in order for communications to occur in that network, a circuit between the endpoints being connected had to be physically constructed and maintained. In the world of the 20th century telephony of, say, around the time that I was born, when John Kennedy was president of the United States, the principle of a long-distance call in that already quite technically sophisticated system was that between your telephone and the central office, a dedicated piece of copper wire was put at the disposal of your call, and similarly, from there to other parts of the system until a great big microwave transmitter in a dish somewhere on the edge of the city or deep in suburbia picked up that circuit and put a segment down that consisted of a microwave beam stretching halfway across the continent, picked up and relayed, and everything down to the copper wire that led to the telephone in Los Angeles. All of it immobilized into a circuit for the purpose of that call. And the moment that call is over, each of those segments to go back and to doing something else, to be built into other parts of the circuit, a highway constructed of segments maintained for the duration of the messaging going on, and then reused. That's circuit switching. And one of the great fathers of information theory, one of the greatest mathematicians of this subject in the later 20th century, Claude Shannon, proved very elegantly in a paper in the early 1950s that only circuit switching, but never packet switching, could carry telephone calls. Because in order to understand packet switching for telephone calls, you would have to ask what would happen when packets arrived out of order or got dropped, and nobody would be able to understand the language at the other end. And all of this was proven with a great deal of mathematical clarity and rigor, which was enormously helpful, but which turned out to be wrong. The rules of a network based on packet switching are the rules that underlie the protocols that we think of in the net, and what they say is each packet may travel a different route to its destination. It may arrive out of order. Some of them may not arrive. And what happens is the endpoints have to sort all that out and conduct negotiation as the thing happens to get that stream of jigsaw puzzle pieces and to sort out which ones they have, no matter what order they came in, and to put them all back together again, and to do so and keep the process of whatever communication it is alive. And so it is literally the case that all of the network assumes, with respect to your Zoomified things, that all of that video and audio can arrive out of order, and some packets can be dropped, and that everybody is just doing their best, which is why not video conferencing? Actually, Claude Shannon is not entirely incorrect. He's just wrong. And you can always push the limits of what human perception will allow, and the network performance has to degrade neatly and easily at the edge when it can't quite achieve what would be necessary. And it can't do that very well over your commodity Wi-Fi to your commodity consumer low-quality bandwidth. And so you get jerky, glitchy video, and your brain begins to melt under hour after hour of trying to do the job it was evolved for, only to discover that the data is just fatally not good enough. But nonetheless, packet switching works beautifully, and more beautifully than you can possibly imagine. And we actually do have a network whose principles are extremely loosely and generously written to allow all kinds of failure tolerance in this nervous system, which is why it is so robust, which is why disasters can afflict us in many different ways, epidemics and hurricanes and all sorts of horrible conditions for the human built and maintained environment, and still the net works. In a city like New Orleans was after Katrina, leveled by the flooding and the damaging of everything, to get working net back up is way easier than to get people clean drinking water. The facts of the anatomy of this net, set in the way that switches and pipes work, and in the flexibility and robustness of the structures, and in the underlying rhythm of packet movement, that this nervous system works in many ways beautifully well. And its evolution from one level of functioning to another has been very quick, very thorough. The anatomy means, however, that in the 21st century, every political issue is about who controls the switches. As we shall see, in all the domains in which we are learning, who controls the switches means who gets the behavior. It shouldn't. We should be architecting the nervous system so that who gets the behavior is not always in question when we determine who controls the switches. Because not every pipe is carrying all the behavior that it is carrying upward from every poor A to a richer and richer billionaire B. We shall see that the anatomy of the net is consistent with freedom. But what the anatomy of the net needed was improvements to the anatomy of freedom, which over the course of the last two decades, because of the political economy underneath, it did not get. We needed a net which had better and better anatomy for freedom, in forms which we will discuss in detail later in the course, like anonymity and location obscurity. We needed improvements to the anatomy that would have resulted in thinning the upflow of behavior in favorem libertatis, in the interest of freedom. But those were not the anatomical improvements that were made. The evolution of the anatomy was not towards greater freedom, but towards greater surveillance. And this because, as Shoshana Zuboff points out, it's surveillance capitalism, stupid. But what we have in the process of the construction of this anatomy is a clear understanding of the ways in which, at the anatomic cellular level, this nervous system was originally constructed for equality, for anti-hierarchy, for freedom of thought, and subjected over time to an increasing structure of the re-evaluation of that anatomy and its evolution anatomically for more surveillance of the consumer more and more at the end. The smartphone is the neuron which encapsulates that process. Anatomically, the smartphone is the mousetrap stage. It's where you get the cheese. And really what it is all the surveillance equipment built around the stage of the mousetrap, so when your tiny little toe hits it, boom, and 2,000 times a day or so your tiny little digit hits it, and boom. But you don't hear the boom. The rod doesn't come directly down on your neck, so it's all fine, right? Very convenient, excellent, very good, thank you very much, wonderful, what would I do without you? That, the process of adjusting the human psychology to the anatomy and physiology of the network, that, when we get there, two steps from now, because we have the physiology to consider and the nature of what physiology is in such an anatomy. But when we get to the third step, where we begin to ask, how does the human nervous system interface with this evolving nervous system? That's when we will begin to recognize that there's life on both sides. The life of the human now being modified in many a successful way, and the life of the parasite, that organism at the other side. Because, you see, when we threw all those neurons together and put them on a substrate, they began to grow. Once upon a time, there was a great literary intelligence chafing under restraint called Mary Shelley. And it told itself a story which even a self-involved poet like her husband could understand. She told the story of the nature of the human impulse to create and the darkness of its unawareness of itself. And the possibility that its own unself-consciousness, its own self-centeredness, its own narcissism in the process of creation could give birth to a monster driven to harm because of its need to understand human. That the tragedy of the monster of Victor Frankenstein is the tragedy of the inability of kin to recognize one another. That it is Oedipus again, but now in a different world, in which the spark of human creativity and the darkness of its unself-knowledge leads to more powerful destruction every time. Well, so we threw these neurons at the substrate and they began to grow, and we added nutrient from the capitalisms, both of them, of the post-Second World War period, and we added our ability to invent the processes of our destruction, and then we narrowly avoid one kind of destruction after another, but in the end, it's what we have created in our narcissistic failure to appreciate who we are that is on the eve of destroying us. Hear you soon.